It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at some of the coolest science headlines with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, including how some fossilized tomatillos are changing what scientists know about one of the most delicious, though sometimes deadly, families of plants.
First, the rift between Wisconsin's conservative lawmakers and the state university system continues to deepen. Some state legislators have criticized courses and programs on UW campuses, saying that they are biased and based on disproportionately liberal ideas.
Assembly Republicans have said that ideological diversity will be one of their priorities in this session, and as the UW asks the state for more funding, there are questions of whether and how lawmakers will use funding as a way to ensure that more conservative ideas are brought to campus.
Nico Savage joins us now. He's the higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Nico, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Nico, what are some of the biggest complaints from Republican legislators who feel that the UW system is biased toward liberal points of view?
Right. Well, a lot of these are sort of longstanding conservative criticisms and complaints about higher education as an institution. The sort of general sense that Republicans have been talking about for decades, that they see institutions of higher education as liberal and elite and places where conservative points of view are, if they're mentioned at all, are unfairly presented. What we've been seeing, though, over the last several months in Wisconsin is sort of an evolution of that into getting into really small detail of UW courses. I talked to someone from the American Association of University Professors who basically said that the level of detail that we're seeing legislators get into, where they're talking specifically about individual UW courses, or even in one case, UW course readings, as we've seen over the past 6 months, is sort of a new level of detail for legislators to get involved in, kind of actively pointing out areas of the university that they're taking issue with.
Can you give us some specific examples of the courses or the reading material that these Republican legislators are objecting to?
Sure. It's predominantly, you know, one of the most vocal critics has been Senator Steve Nass, who's a longtime critic and a frequent critic of the university system. He's taken issue with, for instance, in the last week, a UW-Madison program called the Men's Project that university officials say is meant to get people to kind of think about masculinity and the social constructs of it and how that applies to their life. Senator Nass sees that as sort of an attack on men and a desire to, as he said, a statement that the university believes that parents aren't raising their children right. There's also been, back in July, the senator took issue with a course reading in a sociology course that had to do with essentially sexual preferences that were being discussed on a dating app for gay men. He said that the essay was inappropriate and offensive in that case. And that's sort of a level of detail, again, where often these criticisms are of an institution generally, or sometimes of a professor in particular, but it's rare to see the level of scrutiny on the details that we've seen in the past few months.
So you mentioned Senator Steve Nass, Republican Senator Steve Nass, and there has also been a representative mentioned in this story as well,
yep.
Dave Murphy.
Dave
but
Murphy.
Besides the two of them, is this something that's picking up steam with other Republicans?
Yeah, that's always hard to tell, but I do think that there is some momentum behind this for the Republican caucus broadly. Like I said, you know, the sort of criticism of academia as a liberal institution has been a longstanding one in conservative circles, and we also see now Speaker Robin Voss, the top Republican in the Assembly, through a spokeswoman, told me that one of the ideas that he would like to see in the next budget is tying essentially UW's funding or some portion of UW funding to what conservatives refer to as intellectual diversity when it comes to the, as he put it, the diversity of professors and speaker invitations that come to the university. So that's certainly a powerful Republican who's making a statement that this is going to be a priority for him. And that was also expressed in a sort of laying out of priorities that the Assembly GOP caucus did last year as well.
And how has the university responded from Chancellor Rebecca Blang to some of the professors? What have they said?
Sure. Well, there's been when it comes to the criticism that we've seen from Senator Nass and others, particularly of a recent course on white identity that was kind of well known for its title of The Problem of Whiteness, right? Rebecca Blank penned a She's the chancellor of UW-Madison. She penned a column over the weekend in which she defended that course, said it is a legitimate field of study and that it's the job of a university to take on controversial subjects and to kind of teach them and explore them in a fearless sort of way. You've also seen a lot of faculty push back again to the idea of legislators critiquing individual courses. In fact, an op-ed today by Donald Moynihan, who was a professor I talked with for my story on this topic, has an op-ed in the New York Times where he essentially says that the larger threat to free speech on college campuses comes from what a lot of folks on campus see as meddling in the affairs of the university from legislators and from Republicans.
We're talking with Nico Savage right now, higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's with us to talk about complaints from some state lawmakers about liberal bias in the UW system. And aren't these complaints geared mostly toward UW-Madison, or is this something that's broader and looks at other campuses in different parts of the state, too?
Yeah, that's a good question. Predominantly, where we've seen these complaints directed has been at courses, at professors, and at topics in UW-Madison, but again, it's a long-standing and a wide-ranging critique of higher education generally. There are, across the country, we've seen conservatives who have taken issue with some of the topics, some of the research that goes on at universities, public and private. So it's certainly some of this is being directed at Madison, but it's again a broader criticism that conservatives have long had.
And we were talking about how all this could be codified into law, and the budget is expected to be crafted soon. Do you expect that to be a big part of the funding question?
Right. And this is going to be a big topic to watch. We know that one of the priorities in Governor Scott Walker's budget is going to be tying new funding for the University of Wisconsin system to certain performance metrics, and they still haven't been specified yet. Now, the governor hasn't given any indication that the issue of intellectual diversity is one that he's going to be looking at in his budget. However, again, when you have the Speaker of the Assembly saying that he'd like to see one of the performance metrics being intellectual diversity and sort of the mix of speakers who are professors or who are invited onto campus, that could be an interesting area to watch, and especially because it gets into some important and pretty hard-to-answer questions, right, of how exactly do you determine what constitutes this intellectual diversity? How do you as a legislator write down and codify into law what makes a person a conservative speaker, what makes them a liberal speaker, what makes them whatever other categories there might be? Can you do that, and should that be the role of the government?
In that vein, is it unusual for the intellectual direction of a university to be an item maybe on the state budget?
It is. I mean, generally, you see that those topics are ones that are left up. The topics of what gets taught in a class traditionally have been left up to faculty and to administrators and to governing boards and that sort of thing. And this is raising a lot of alarms among faculty and among free speech advocates who basically are concerned that this could lead to legislators dictating curriculum. And they say that's a bad thing.
Now, as you said, this has gotten some national attention so far. Do you expect this issue to blow up and be a focal point, maybe as a proxy for the bigger battles in the rest of the country?
I think that's certainly possible. We saw this a year ago, two years ago, with the sort of fights right over the future of tenure at the University of Wisconsin system. If there is any sort of effort to legislate ideological diversity on campus, I think you definitely see a lot of coverage of that from the sort of higher education press nationally.
Nico, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
That was Nico Savage, higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He was with us to talk about complaints from some Republican state lawmakers about liberal bias in the UW system.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talk about NPR's Community Conversation, A Nation Engaged, looking at the big issues facing Wisconsin and the Milwaukee area.
Right now, a new paper in Science breaks down what researchers learned from a pair of fossilized tomatillos from Argentina. They're part of the nightshade family, which also includes edible plants like tomatoes, along with the deadly poison belladonna.
Gemma Tarlac joins us now to break down this and other science news. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, and happy 2017 to all of you.
Happy 2017 to you, too. Well, we've got some tomatillos here to start out with, some very, very old tomatillos, it turns out. So what's exceptional about these?
Yeah, you don't want to be putting these in your salsa, trust me. Yeah, so this is an amazing find. They found in Argentina these two absolutely beautifully preserved fossilized tomatillos. And if you're not a huge tomatillo fan, you've seen them in the supermarket. You've had them in your salsa verde. They look like tomatoes wearing these little paper jackets called husks. And basically, the husks were perfectly preserved. I mean, seriously, they look like something you'd find in maybe your compost bin last week. And one of the cherries within, or one of the berries within the husk was still preserved as well. And the thing is, these tomatillos are 52.2 million years old. And that is a huge thing because we don't know that much about how the nightshade family developed. And, you know, you mentioned nightshades include tomatoes and tomatillos and belladonna, but they also include potatoes and eggplant and peppers and tobacco even and petunias. I can't forget the petunias. So it's a huge, huge family of plants, but we really had very little information about when they evolved. And based on the scant information we had and doing some modeling, they thought that nightshades had evolved 35 to 51 million years ago, like 51 was the upper limit for nightshades. But these tomatillos, again, are 52.2 million years old. And tomatillos are some of the younger nightshades, the last to evolve. So nightshades must be tens of million years older than we thought.
Right, because if there are these tomatillos 52 million years ago, there are probably their cousins that eventually led up to the petunias and the eggplants and the other stuff, and it must have taken a long time for those to split off from the same common ancestor.
Absolutely. I mean, they didn't want to speculate on how far back nightshade evolution started based on these fossilized tomatillos, but it seriously, it has to be tens of millions of years before we thought it was, which is, it's always exciting when you find that big of a difference. And when you find it based on evidence that is pretty clear, it's very well dated. So it's not like they're guessing. They can be very sure that these tomatillos are indeed that old.
And Gemma, this inspired you to do some cooking with tomatillos. Did you feel any differently about them than you might have before, knowing how ancient their roots are?
I did. And, you know, I have to say, the first year I lived in my house, I planted tomatillos just to see what would happen. And these things were like predators. They took out my cucumbers. They went mano a mano with my tomatoes. And the next year, I didn't plant them, but they came back.
Wow.
It's funny because, yeah, tomatillos are kind of like this invasive monster in my garden every year now. And now, you know, I now have a freezer full of them, but I'm going to give them a little more respect. You know, they may have coexisted with the dinosaurs. Who knows?
Before we move on, Gemma, for studying the evolution of animals, we leave things like bones and teeth around that make it easy to study. For plants, is it pretty rare to find something like a 50-million-year-old piece of fruit?
Yeah, it depends, especially for like fruits and the flowers. That's very rare just because, you know, they're more delicate, they're more water-based, they degrade faster. So you'll find, you know, the hard seeds, for example, or even pollen, but it is very rare to find plants, the actual berries and the paper husks this old.
We're talking with Gemma Tarlak right now, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She's with us with some of the coolest news from the world of science. And Gemma, there has been some persistent thinking about the human brain and the size of human teeth, and that was the brains got bigger, and so our teeth could get smaller because we didn't need to tear stuff up with our teeth so much because we could make tools and do other sophisticated things. What's this new study about?
Yeah, this is really interesting because it kind of like the tomatillos, it really rewrites what we thought we knew about this particular topic. And in this case, you know, absolutely, like you said, we've long thought that our brains got bigger and our teeth got smaller because with our big brains, we could figure out how to make stone tools that sliced and diced. We could figure out how to make a fire to cook our food over so it wasn't so hard to chew. So that has long been the assumption. Bigger brains and smaller teeth kind of went hand in hand in evolutionary terms. However, this team looked at several different hominin species. They looked at Australopithecus, which of course predates our own genus, but they also looked at the Homo genus, as well as two members of Paranthropus, which is kind of like an offshoot of the hominids that very distantly related to the Homo genus. And they looked at all of the skulls and the tooth size and the brain size and shape. And what they figured out was the teeth kind of got smaller at a steady rate. That was pretty much across the record the same thing. And the brain size, brain shape can be an indicator of cognitive function. They found the brain shape changed, but again, pretty much at a steady rate, not as steady as the teeth. But when then they looked at brain size, and they saw that there was really no correlation between brain size growth and tooth size shrinkage. So there would be these spurts of brain growth, but they were not reflected in the teeth shrinkage at the same rates. So it's very interesting and kind of flies in the face of what we thought we knew.
So that means what? We need a new explanation for why the teeth are getting smaller?
Well, yeah, and you know, the researchers, they were not about to say confidently, this means this, and, you know, settle the debate. This is just another round in an ongoing debate. But basically, they think that there were a lot of different environmental factors about teeth size, you know, in terms of what's available to eat, the kind of environment you're living in, all these different elements. And that is separate from brain size, because brain size is, of course, impacted by the environment you're in, but it's also impacted by things like, are you living in a social group? You know, there are all these different other things. So they think they're two separate, mostly separate factors that impact brain size and tooth size.
And you're right about how it is pretty striking if you were to line up a human or even an older human than we are today with a bonobo or a chimpanzee, the teeth size is pretty different.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if you go to the paper, and there's a link on my blog to it where you can read the paper for yourself and see the actual comparisons of, you know, the different sizes of the molars, and it's absolutely striking. And there were a lot of theories, everything from, well, say chimpanzees need much larger molars because they do a lot more chewing of fibrous plants, whatever. There are a lot of theories in that direction, but for a long time, we really thought that the smaller teeth were tied to the bigger brains, and now that's not the case.
Let's move on to some more research. This one from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, looking at dinosaur eggs. First of all, dinosaurs 65 million years ago, they ended, so they could have been munching on tomatillos the whole time. This shakes up our picture of what kind of salsa dinosaurs might have made and eaten. But this new research focusing on dinosaur eggs.
Yes. Specifically what was inside the dinosaur eggs, and specifically the jaws of the embryonic dinosaurs. Our CT scanning has gotten so good, such high resolution, that they were able, for the first time ever, this has been done, to look inside the eggs at the teeth of the developing dinosaur embryos and actually find these things called von Ebner lines. And they're basically like tree rings for teeth, except they're daily. Any animal that has teeth, as it develops, every day it gets like another von Ebner line on its teeth. And so they were able to see these superfine lines in the teeth of the embryonic dinosaurs. And that just blows my mind in and of itself, that they were able to actually see lines on something that, you know, went extinct 65 million years ago. That's crazy. But then what they saw in the lines has changed what we thought about how long dinosaur eggs had to be, you know, how long it took for them to hatch. And basically, we thought dinosaur eggs were probably similar to birds, because birds are, after all, living dinosaurs. But birds have a very fast incubation period. So they lay their eggs, little bit incubation, eggs hatch, and boop, little birdie, born into the world. Huzzah. We thought that's what dinosaurs did too. But they found out, looking at these von Ebner lines and the dinosaur embryos and basically counting them, that dinosaurs have an incubation period, the eggs, of about 3 to 6 months. And that's more than twice as long as birds. It's a lot longer than some species of birds. And what does this all mean? Well, it means that more time of the dinosaur's life cycle is spent incubating in an egg. So it makes them a little less efficient, and they think when the great mass extinction event happened about 66 million years ago at the end of the Cretaceous, they think that maybe dinosaurs had a harder time surviving it because it was taking them so long. Their life cycle took just a little bit longer, which affected the number of eggs that would hatch, which affects the survival rate of the baby and juvenile dinosaurs. It's super exciting stuff, but it's very early. I want to caution people that this is not carved in stone, because the two dinosaur eggs, the two species of dinosaur eggs they looked at, they're both ornithischian dinosaurs. And these are herbivores, kind of the cows and sheep of the Cretaceous. They don't have any eggs, to my knowledge, certainly not in this study, but we don't have any eggs that are really well preserved but belong to the super fast predators along which the bird line evolved. So maybe if we found some of those dinosaurs, the theropods, which were predatory and a lot more faster and agile, maybe we would see more bird-like incubation rates.
All right, so this is exciting stuff, but it's early. Are we likely to find one of these eggs of these really speedy predator dinosaurs so we can put some of this to bed a little?
Yeah, you know, we have found eggs from theropods. I don't believe they are as well preserved as these. And really, the scope of this study was just to see, can we even find the von Ebner lines? And they did, which is phenomenal. So now that they've been successful in figuring out the incubation periods of these two herbivorous ornithischian dinosaurs, I bet you any money they are going to be scouring museum collections all over the place looking for well-preserved theropod eggs that have already been found. And, you know, the next paleontological find is just a dig away. It could be right under the surface, under our feet. So maybe this summer they'll find one. Who knows? But it's just exciting that they have proven that they're able to even count the von Ebner lines, to find them, number one, and to find them at such a high resolution that they can count them and determine the incubation period.
Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joined us to break down some of the coolest news from the world of science.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out what NPR's political correspondent Don Gagne is hearing from Americans in the lead-up to Inauguration Day. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we get a political expert's predictions on what stories might dominate the headlines this year in Wisconsin politics.
First, in the lead up to Inauguration Day, NPR is teaming up with local stations around the country to get a sense of the strengths, hopes, and challenges facing individual communities. The tour is called A Nation Engaged. On Wednesday, NPR's national political correspondent Don Gagne will be in Milwaukee with speakers from Wisconsin Family Action, NAACP Milwaukee, and more, along with WPR's own assistant news director Kyla Calvert-Mason and members of the Milwaukee area community.
Don Gagne joins us now to talk about A Nation Engaged and what he's learned over this last year covering the election. Don, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be coming back to the Great Midwest next couple days.
We're glad to have you. Well, let's start up by looking at the idea. What is the idea behind A Nation Engaged?
So tonight, On Point Radio is doing a special program, kind of getting a variety of perspectives and call-ins about what people are looking for from the new administration. Now, separate from that, we're doing these series of community events around the country. There's one in Sacramento. I believe there may be one in St. Louis. Certainly, there's the one in Milwaukee this week, and we want to kind of have the same kind of discussion, but really focused on a place and a community. And the very basic question that we start with is, and all of these start with the same thing, what do you want the new president to know about you or your community as he takes office? And then we'll just start the discussion from there.
Well, the election results this year surprised some people, and they highlighted the fact that we're a nation of very different lived experiences some of the time. And with that in mind, what do you hope conversations like the one you're having in Milwaukee on Wednesday will bring to light?
we all know where the disagreements are, right? I mean, we heard them all year. We heard them in certainly not the most nuanced way all year, from candidates or from surrogates or even from people on the ground. You know, regular folks who were so vested in the outcome or still trying to make up their mind. But what I hope we can do is find areas where there are agreement, find places where there might be a little give that's willing to be given and a little take that's willing to be taken from the other side, so that we can have something that actually does get to a very serious discussion. Obviously, you get people from different perspectives, right? We'll have Hillary Clinton voters there. We'll have Donald Trump voters there. You know, we may have some folks who aren't with one of the independent parties, but you don't expect it to be all. Can't we all just get along? Let's figure out a way to go forward. But it's nice to have a good civil discussion, the way you might with a family member who you know and love, who you disagree with, and you might over beers or over dinner have a very civil conversation. That's what I'm hoping that this will be.
You're hoping for that, and still this is raw for a lot of people. Donald Trump has not taken office yet. The inauguration is until the 20th. Do you think that America is ready to have the conversation you're hoping that it will have?
Well, that's the question, right? And we're not asking anybody to forgive and forget and all that. I mean, if you're emotional about this, if you feel serious about this, one way or another, no matter which side you were on, then that's absolutely fine. But we do want to try to find a way to have a conversation going forward that does really kind of wrestle with some of these things.
Here in Wisconsin, we are a state that has been divided by a lot of partisan rancor on both sides for the past few years ago. Do you see Wisconsin as a lab for the kind of conversations that will be happening in the rest of the country, either with NPR or without?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, obviously, a lot of it will depend on the panelists and the audience, and I'll do my best to kind of keep it going as a real conversation. But having spent as much time in Wisconsin as I have, during not just during the Scott Walker years, but before that, I've kind of seen how raw it is and how raw it continues to be in many places on certain issues. So, Wisconsin being obviously a battleground state and one of the surprise states that, left that long-standing tradition of voting for Democrats in presidential elections, in this particular election, in some ways it's a really great place, maybe the perfect place to have this conversation, but you also go into it, very, very aware of what the people of Wisconsin, have gone through in these intense battles within the state over the past couple of cycles.
NPR's Don Gagne is with us now. He's NPR's national political correspondent, and he'll be in Milwaukee on the 11th, on Wednesday, to facilitate a community conversation called A Nation Engaged. And Don, you said you spent a lot of time in Wisconsin over the past few years, and I wonder, as a political reporter who travels a lot, who talks to a lot of people, what strikes you about where Wisconsin is politically and what the big issues are here?
Wisconsin is always interesting, as for me, you've got the entire upper Midwest. I grew up in Southeast Michigan and worked for many years out of Detroit for NPR. But Wisconsin, you obviously have, the huge rural swaths of the state, which tend to vote a certain way. You've got the urban areas, you've got college towns, so you've got all of that in a state that is You know, it's easier to get around Wisconsin than say Pennsylvania or Florida. Florida, you can drive forever, you know, across the state. So there's something about how you can find so many different points of views, you know, kind of within the confines of this state. And I also always find it fascinating how different Wisconsin is in either the midterm elections or say in a special election than it is in a general election. And I will tell you, it's one of those states, and I don't think everybody's just being kind of kind to a former Midwesterner who's showing up, where people are willing to sit down, they're willing to talk, they're willing to, you know, let you kind of slide in next to them in the booth at the diner, or come to their house and talk to them, or at the Union Hall or wherever. And as a reporter, that's something that I've always really appreciated.
What issues do you think got overlooked until the election that might be thrown into the spotlight now when you open up that corner booth on Wednesday?
That's a good question. I don't know that I can presuppose what people there might think should have been covered more or maybe less for that matter. Mostly I just want to kind of have an open mind and try to guide the discussion and ask pointed questions and kind of push and pull a little bit as we go along.
Don Gagne is with us now. He's NPR's national political correspondent, and he'll be in Milwaukee this Wednesday evening to facilitate a community conversation called A Nation Engaged.
And we'd like to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What's your answer to that question Don posed a few minutes ago? What do you want the new president to know about you or your community as he takes office? And what local issues might have gotten lost in the campaign or been oversimplified? And are you able still to have civil conversations with friends or family members who disagree with you politically? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And Don Gagne is with us now. He's NPR's national political correspondent. He'll be in Milwaukee this Wednesday evening to take part in a community conversation called A Nation Engaged. The event aims to get at the hopes, challenges, and strengths in your community. And last check, the event was at capacity, but we can have this conversation right now on the radio.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. The opening question at this community event: what do you want the new president to know about you or your community as he takes office? What local issues might have gotten lost in the campaign or been oversimplified? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take our first caller now. We have Dan joining us in Stevens Point. Dan, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The issue that I would like to have President-elect Trump consider is climate change. At one time, I think it was 2009, he was very supportive of climate change action, and since then he has called it a hoax and has backed away from his earlier positions on it. But I can think of no more important issue facing our entire civilization than the climate crisis, which we are now facing. It's going to have a tremendous impact on Wisconsin, already is having a tremendous impact here, and is going to have an impact throughout the nation.
Thank you for that call, Dan. I appreciate hearing what you're thinking about. And Don, climate change is something that some environmentalists are concerned about with the election of Donald Trump. Where do you see this conversation going, evolving?
Well, and I'll tell you, I mean, you asked specifically what were things that didn't get kind of a full airing during the campaign. I mean, excuse me, obviously climate change, you know, came up. But I, if my memory serves me, I don't think there was a single question about climate change in any of the presidential debates, which strikes me as interesting. Here's the thing about Donald Trump. Kind of setting aside his personality and his Twitter feed and all of that kind of stuff, if we can do that for a moment, there are so many issues where he has been all over the map and, you know, been on one side and then the other over the course of his, I was going to say public life. I guess he has been in public, even though he's been in private business the whole time. I don't mean his time as a public official, but and climate change is one of those. And we don't know exactly what he will start to do, how he will view that issue once he gets to the White House. Now, there was plenty that Republicans who are, you know, suspicious of the climate change science found to not like about him over the course of the primary campaign. That and then certainly once we got to the general election, your caller is right. You know, the word hoax, the hoax came up, and his EPA pick, Scott Pruitt, is certainly not someone who has been, interested or sympathetic is a better word to any of the, you know, arguments put forth by the majority of climate scientists. So, you know, that's one thing on the ledger that we can certainly look at and to begin to judge him by. But It is one of those issues where we can't say a lot at this point.
Dan, thanks so much for the call and the thoughts. And we're going to go next to Kathy in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Hi. What I expect from the next 4 years is a lot of bloviating rhetoric and spin and confusion. I am probably obviously a Hillary voter, but I have lots of friends and family who voted for Trump. Some who are longtime Republicans, never Trumpers, but in the end, there was an issue that was dear to them, and they ended up voting for Trump, thinking he was going to come through for them. And I have other people who, on the south, you know, blue collar, working class, Southside Milwaukee, union people who are my friends and family who I grew up with, who I understand the middle class problems that they've had going way back to the Reagan years, the slow, dribble of you know loss that they've had over all these decades, but I still can't believe that it was Trump who they think is going to solve the problems for them.
And Kathy, how do you find it having conversations with the people who disagreed with you in the election?
Very hard, really hard. I had breakfast with a friend of mine who from high school was a longtime Republican who was one of the never Trumpers, but then ended up voting for Trump. And it was just difficult. I mean, she threw the Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas thing at me and denies that there are 20 million people on Obamacare. And I came home and I said to my husband, I'm not sure how I'm going to maintain this friendship for the next
Kathy, thank you so much for sharing all that, your thoughts. And Kathy, still finding it hard. She is not so much in a place wanting to inform the next administration, but she's still struggling with the day-to-day life, living part of disagreeing politically right now, Don.
I think I remember that the Marquette University poll of maybe 2 years ago, so it wasn't about this presidential election, but it was how a majority of people said personal relationships and family relationships had been affected by the polarized politics in the state. I think we would have found the same thing and then some, you know, with the 2016 poll asking the same question. But it's, you know, Donald Trump continues to say that, you know, he is going to unite the country. The interesting thing, though, is that, you know, if you're looking at his Twitter feed, which sometimes we're told we're not supposed to take literally, I'm not sure how else to take it, because it is now, you know, an official statement from the president-elect. But he calls, you know, just this week, you know, Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, a clown. Today he called Meryl Streep, just because she made those remarks at the Golden Globes last night, you know, a loser. And those are just two examples from the last, you know, 72 hours or so. Forgive my cough that I'm still kind of wrestling
okay.
with here.
It's winter.
It's exactly. But so, you know, so his best position, his argument that he puts forth that he will unite people seems to be once you see the results, people will come around once the jobs start coming back or whatever. Obviously, we have no data to base anything on at that point. I mean, we have a few announcements here and there about car companies and investments, but the connection of those announcements to Trump is not particularly strong at this point. So it's going to be really fascinating in these places where people who voted different ways do come together, see how they navigate this coming administration as well.
Don Gagne is with us right now, NPR's national political correspondent. He's going to be in Milwaukee on Wednesday evening to take part in a community conversation like the one we're having right now called A Nation Engaged. And the starting question, what do you want the new president to know about you or your community as he takes office? This is in the lead up to Inauguration Day. And you can call us with your thoughts on that question at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let's take another caller now. We've got Tim joining us in La Crosse. Tim, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
Oh, well, I believe that we're more racially divided than we ever have with Obama. He's split the country up pretty good.
And so you're hopeful for the future for the Trump inauguration?
Well, that it'd be at least get better than what it is. It's been he said that it's better now than it ever was. Obama did, but I find that I haven't heard a person that would agree with that.
Tim, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate that. And Don, Tim is saying that President Obama has been a divisive president, that the nation is more racially divided than it was 8 years ago. And he thinks we can do better with a new president, with Donald Trump. What do you think about that?
I mean, there are certainly still racial divisions in this country, and I think President Obama would be the first to say that his presence in the White House and his presidency have not, kind of waved a magic wand and fixed any of that. And whether it's worse than it was 8 years ago, that's not for me to say. It's going to be a challenge for a President Trump as well. He did do, if you look at the exit polls, about as well as Mitt Romney, and certainly better than expected among Hispanic and Latino voters. He did not do well among African American voters. There were some turnout questions there, obviously this is going to be a major issue going forward for this country, certainly.
All right, time for one more quick call. Connor is next in Cumberland. Hi, Connor.
Hi, I just wanted to talk about kind of the difference between small town and big town. I'm from a small town in northern Wisconsin, but I go to college in the Milwaukee area, and I just find it interesting looking at how differently people respond to things like the Milwaukee riots, for example. At my school, it was a huge thing because it was so close. But then I went home for Thanksgiving and, there were people I talked to that didn't even realize it had happened. And I feel that those differences were kind of not necessarily highlighted in a lot of the debates and the rhetoric surrounding the election.
Connor, thank you so much for sharing that perspective. And Don, this is something that a lot of people say was borne out on Election Day in where the votes turned out for Donald Trump. And briefly, we've got less than a minute here, but what do you say to Connor?
It's certainly a very real divide, and one that is getting a lot more attention, I think, the urban-rural divide in the country. I did some stories on that over the course of the campaign from Colorado and elsewhere. As you said, you look at the map. The urban areas are blue. The vast rural areas are red. And that's the divide right there.
And Don, you're coming to Milwaukee, and you said you've also got Sacramento coming up. Where else can people see you?
So this is the one I'm doing. We've got Sam Sanders is doing the one in Sacramento. My colleague Sarah McCammon is doing one. I want to say that's in St. Louis, but I'm not 100% sure. And then Asma Khalid, my other colleague from the elections desk, is also doing one. And I suspect there will be more of these as the first year of the Trump administration plays out.
And we look forward to having you, Don. Thanks for joining us.
All right, I will bring honey and maybe some whiskey with me on stage.
Excellent. Don Gagne, NPR's national political correspondent. He'll be in Milwaukee on Wednesday.
On Friday, we talked about the American Dialect Society's nominees for the Word of the Year with Grant Barrett from the public radio show Away with Words.
Later on, Grant and his fellow word experts got together to vote on the word or phrase that best defined 2016.
And the winner was the phrase dumpster fire, which got a lot of use during the 2016 election campaign.
From the press release, quote, defined as an exceedingly disastrous or chaotic situation, the term dumpster fire was selected as best representing the public discourse and preoccupations of the last year.
Now, I saw this a lot on social media. People would refer to a particular campaign that was going through a rough cycle as being in the midst of a dumpster fire. Often they'd just post a picture. Our guest Harry Enten from 538.com.
A lot of
he'd
dumpster
often
fires.
Post, yeah, just yeah. A picture of a dumpster fire and say live from the blank campaign. But do people actually say this in conversation, I wonder?
I feel like it's more of an internet meme that you type and less of one that you say. You and I, of course, saw a real-life embodied sort of truck dumpster fire.
Right, right. We're walking back. There's a parking lot. There's a pile of garbage on fire. Turned out a dump truck. This is like, we may have talked about this last summer. And the driver's like, well, I'll just dump this burning trash in the parking lot. I guess it was good for the dump truck. Anyway, dumpster fire, word of the year. 2016. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.